Yes.
So what's been going on in RPGs? Welcome to the DM Roundtable.
This very special episode of the DMR.
That's right.
Is it
we will be having a conversation without being cut off by Thaddeus.
Oh, she went there already. Boom! Bam!
Dang.
There we are. Okay.
Sorry.
I leave it in, Sam. I suggest you leave it in. I endorse that decision, so that's okay. Love you, Thad.
I know. I kid because I love him.
That's right.
But not in that creepy internet stalker way either.
Yeah.
Right.
Good to clarify that. Yeah. Let's just make that perfectly clear. Oh, should talk about is how we totally missed Sam up on that table.
Yeah.
That Gen Con, man. I'm telling you.
Sam, you missed it. We had two Tome Show t-shirts throwing the DMR. At Gen Con. I was wearing one and Mike Shea was wearing one.
Oh, that's nice. Right. Yep.
We were wearing the same
way. Way to represent. That's what it's supposed to be, right?
Yeah, well, I didn't have a DMR shirt, and I needed to wear it to the... I was going to wear it to the media meet and greet, and then I decided to change anyway.
Hmm.
I should stop by as a guest on the Tome Show. I've never been on the Tome Show. Griner said he would do it sometime. In fact, we were going to record something while we were at Gen Con. We never got around to it, so... I had breakfast with him one morning, though, and that was kind of nice. Good guy. Jeff. Yep. Jeff Griner. Griner.
So, we've talked about a lot of stuff, I think, during the past week on Twitter, at least. But you're going to say something, Sam?
Things. Oh, go ahead, Sam.
No, I was going to say, what topic do we want to hit on tonight?
Well, I don't know if I want to hit on a topic, but...
Well, we already know you don't have the hots for Thad, so, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, an established fact. There we go.
Established fact.
Yes. But there have been some things going on. Horribly, I can't recall any of them at the moment.
I know. I was like, I know the stuff that I've been thinking about, which is reading. I've been reading Adventure Bringer for Burning Wheel.
Mm.
And that's been kind of cool.
Now, Burning Wheel uses what? What's the mechanic? I mean, what's the engine? Or does it use its own engine?
It's the Burning Wheel system.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I mean, I'm new to it, so I don't know. I don't remember all the details of the mechanics. But so one of the big things about it is that it's your character's beliefs drive it a lot. I don't know. Sam, have you played it yet?
I have not played it. No. Amazingly enough.
So is that part of the... I'm sorry, Sam.
Go ahead. No, go ahead.
No. Is that part of, like... character origin stuff that helps drive the gameplay? Or is it, like, ongoing throughout the game that your character's own belief structure... Like,
yeah,
does it help? Okay.
It's supposed to be led by your character's beliefs, and your character's beliefs can change through the game. Like, after every session, you should be looking at your beliefs... and they can be simple as you could have gone through this whole dungeon and then found a sword. And, you know, one character might believe that sword, and this is from one of the games they give as a demo. One character, the elf, could believe that his father forged that sword and is the rightful owner. And then the dwarf could be like, oh, actually, you know, that was stolen from my family and I need to bring it back. So, So the thing is, after you find the sword, your beliefs could change depending on who gets it and which path you decide to go with it.
So it's not necessarily, when you say belief, it's not necessarily a religion thing.
Right.
Or a faith thing. It's more of a perception thing.
It's like aspects, Randall.
Right.
Okay.
But they're called beliefs in this game. They're sort of your motivations.
Okay. Now I'm getting it now.
So right. the game, the actual system is, it's a D6 dice pool system.
Okay.
And they use, you know, point-based skills, and you have, like, traits and aspects called beliefs. And you like the character generation is, it's called the life path system. Okay. It's basically a life path. So basically when you generate your character, you generate it from birth so that by the time you're done, you have all these beliefs and that's you use to motivate your character based on the history of the character.
Oh, I see. Okay. That makes sense.
And so then if you're put into a situation where like Tracy said, with that scenario, the sword, that one is used at cons a lot because what it does is it puts all the characters in oppositional positions to each other. And then they have to use, it forces them to use the system and their beliefs to try to solve the problem, which is who's going to get to actually end up with the sword. Because everybody's goal basically is to get the sword.
Okay. Yeah, I think I see it. See, ladies and gentlemen, you listeners out there, even an old guy like me can learn new things about new games. And that is why it's awesome to listen to the DM Roundtable.
Thanks for the ad.
Hey.
It's like it's like hearing an ad or seeing an ad for the Oprah show while you're watching Oprah.
Exactly. But yeah, without all the touchy-feely bullcrap.
Yeah, yeah.
So there you go.
Well, we're not giving everybody in the audience a car or a set of makeup.
Wouldn't that be sweet, though?
That would be awesome. Can we do that?
We can if it's – we'll role play it, okay?
There you go, yeah.
So, yeah, it'll all be virtual and yeah, there you go.
Anyway, back to the topic. So, Tracy,
sorry.
Now that I've totally stomped on you and tried to explain the system that you were already doing a good enough job of, did you like Adventure Burner?
I haven't gotten that far into it, so that's why I'm perfectly okay with somebody else describing it. But I think there's a lot of interesting stuff there with the belief and stuff, but I don't know if I actually want to... The book itself doesn't make me want to play Burning Wheel, but mm-hmm. I kind of already knew that, I think, going in.
Yeah.
It's written to be very masculine, and one of the things they emphasize in it is, like, this is a game of learning the rules, of rules mastery over time. And that's not something that I particularly like. No, I think it's still worth playing a game of it. I'm not saying that. And I will go in and, you know, try to enjoy it for what it is. But the overemphasis on masculine pronouns and things like gentlemen's agreements and stuff, while it makes sense in the implied setting of Burning Wheel, it just turns me off.
So I owned, notice that's past tense, I owned the revised edition. I owned, you know, the two main books, and then there's the Adventure Burner and the Magic Burner and the Monster Burner. So I owned all those books. And I read through...
Oh, you said Magic Burner. I thought you said Magic Burger.
No, yeah. Magic,
wait, that's
magic
like out of context.
That's like Ninja Burger, but
what
in
is the
fantasy.
Magic Burger?
Yeah.
It's like, wow. Sorry, go ahead.
No, sorry, Magic Burner. Everything is a burner because it's basically the game is a system for you to set up a game. Right? It's a burner because you burn through, you know, that basically the books that you buy, they help you burn through the game.
Okay.
And so you when you go through it and you burn through it, it actually produces something that's more than the sum of its parts, right? So whereas, you know, some people might say, well, when you read the D&D manual, it teaches you how to play D&D and the game is encompassed within the manuals. And the Burning Wheel, though, is more like, here's a system of how to think about playing this game such that when you all get together and play this game, it becomes more than what you began with. That's sort of the idea. At least that's how I sort of – what I got from it. I read about half of the main two books, and I decided two things. Number one, it wasn't quite the game that I wanted it to be. And number two, I would never probably really find out if it was because I wasn't going to be able to find a group that would play it with me. So I ended up getting rid of the books.
Well, and you know, and I've said this before several times. It's like once you get invested and start playing a game, at least when you've established a family and you have, you know, a real job that you're doing on a regular basis, it's hard to go and learn a whole brand new complicated game just, you know, because you want to, or to even find people to play it. So, you know, and that's but it sounds like it sounds interesting.
I think it would be one of those things
that steal elements.
Yeah,
from,
I mean, don't get me wrong. It's got some moments of brilliant. Like I read some of the parts, I was like, wow, that's a brilliant way to present that, to to look at that and to make that part of this game is brilliant. But I just, it just wasn't something that my face-to-face group would,
right,
would be able to do. And I don't really particularly see it as a game I could do online. Now, if I had system mastery already, I could, but because it is really intense in that way that you just don't get system mastery after a couple times, you have to play it for a long time. Because of that whole synthesis, sort of synergistic, it becomes more than what you began with. That takes a long time. So, you know, so that was one of the reasons. So I actually gave mine away. I didn't sell them. I gave them away in the what's called, I'm going to put a huge plug in here for RPG Geek, because they have a thing called the Chain of Generosity. And basically what you do is you can put up something to give away, and people, they don't pay, they post in it, oh, I would like that item. And the deal is when, you know, you randomly decide out of all the people that wanted it, who gets it, and then you it's not randomly, like you think, oh, I want Joe to have it. You, like, roll a die, there's a die rolling mechanism.
Oh, cool.
And whoever randomly comes up to win it, you geek mail them, and you get their address, and you send it to them, and the deal is now they have to put something up.
Oh, it's like a trade or an exchange. Yeah, that's a cool idea.
So, and then random. So, but it's not like I give to you and you give to me. It's like I'm going to put this out there, and the next person, whoever wins it, is going to put something up, and then I can bid for that. You know, bid as in just say I want in. It's not a money bid. And
right,
then if I win, then my deal is I win that thing, and then I agree to put another thing up. You know.
Right.
Anyway, that's what I did with it.
Yeah.
So some happy person got my Burning Wheel set, and I'm sure they're happy with it because it's a very good system. It gets very good, you know, ratings from people who play it, and lots of people love it. It just wasn't something I could get my group to play.
Yeah. One of the things that's interesting to me is just how, particularly in a game that's, you know, supposed to be based around beliefs, to me, it's really important in how they present that, because if they present it in, like, this implied setting that's supposed to be sort of medieval-based, and, you know, you could have... And gender could be an important topic.
Mm-hmm.
To me, it kind of pushes people towards making it an important topic. And that's what is part of what drives me away, is that, you know, if it comes up, it's likely going to be in a way that I don't like. Like, I don't...
Wow.
You know, people are more likely to bring up that gender oppression than they are gender equality.
Right.
And even if I don't have my character have that as a belief or anything, the increased likelihood is just what makes me scared of even playing it with strangers. And that's probably how I'd have to play it. So
it's going to be one of those situations where you're going to end up playing with some guy who thinks that all women are chattel, that kind of thing.
Or even just like that they feel that's what should be in the setting because of the way it's written. Like, it's written with very much masculine bent. Like, it's assumed that all the people, all the players, not all the players, but like that a lot of the characters are going to be male because that was the implied setting to it.
The thing about it is that it does have a very masculine feel, and the game is it's very much set up so that it could be extremely confrontational, and you can have a lot of PvP. And I think that's traditionally seen as sort of a very masculine way to deal with things, right? So when they wrote that into the system, and when it sort of became a main portion of the system, it pushes it towards that entire masculine feel, because it's not really like that's a tiny part of the system. It's like the whole system is based on conflict resolution that is aggressive. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Now, is it based on books, or is it an original screenplay, if you will?
It's an original. It's Luke Crane wrote it, and it's from the mind of Luke Crane. He's also the guy, by the way, who did Mouse Guard, and lots of people call Mouse Guard.
Oh, okay.
Lots of people call Mouse Guard Burning Wheel Light, but it's not really Burning Wheel Light.
Burning Wheel Evolved.
Yeah. It has a very different feel to it. Even though it uses the same sort of a dice pool mechanic, it's a very, very different game.
Okay.
But it does focus on conflict resolution, but it's in a much less, you know. See, the problem with this is it's really hard to describe when you say something is very masculine focused. It's really, you know, that immediately evokes people's own internal thoughts of what that word means. And so to say that, you know, Mouse Guard is Burning Wheel Light, and Burning Wheel is very masculine, that people might take that over to Mouse Guard then and say, oh, well, that's a very conflict-driven masculine game, and that it's not really, even though it uses the same kind of mechanics. So it's very different. But it is a very... Burning Wheel is very... And it's really difficult to describe how it, how it works.
Maybe this would be a good time that I would never probably play Mouse Guard because I do not like anthropomorphized animals. I just don't. It's, you know, I read a series of books back when I was in junior high, and it was back when Piers Anthony was doing a bunch of stuff, and and there were other, and I can't remember for the life of me what the series of this books was, but a great deal of them were anthropomorphized animals.
Was it mice, Randall?
No. But I read I have read the Nim. I read the Secret of Nim.
No,
those weren't really anthropomorphized because those were actual mice. But
I was thinking Well, see, but when you say anthropomorphize, so the rats of Nim. That's not what I was thinking. I was thinking of the Redwall series by Brian Jakes, which has like 20 books or something.
No, it's not that many. No, it's not that one. This only had like 4 books in the series.
Well, back when you were when you read it, it probably did only have 4 books.
No. This was a complete 4 series set. It was a complete 4 book set. Sorry. Yeah. I just can't remember the name of it off the top of my head. And then I just finished reading The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, and it's like, you know what? I'm done with talking animals. Oh my God. I was just at that point, and I've never been able to go back. And so it's like, oh, it's got talking animals in it, yay! You know, so, and I don't know why that is. You know, Disney animals talk and stuff. You know, those movies are okay. I just, if I'm gonna role play, I want humanoids. I don't want talking animals if I can avoid it. So,
well, you know, you play what you want. You know, it's preference.
Oh, no,
right?
Exactly.
I know a couple of people who really only want to play games where all the PCs are animals.
Yeah, there's quite a few people that are like that.
Yeah, and I'm not talking about, you know, the furry section of the hobby.
No, I'm not talking about
people who actually dress up. I'm just talking about people who really just they enjoy playing animals, and so they love games like Mouse Guard and TMNT and several of the actual what they would consider better games.
Yeah.
The more indie flavored games. So, interesting. Well, you're going to have to figure out what that book series was because I have to put it in the show notes.
Yeah, I will. I'll probably have to like call my brother or my sister and find out. It's just like, I mean, talking about going to the dim past. I mean, literally when I was in junior high is when I read this. So this would have been early 80s.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Wow. But anyway, that's for another I'll have to come up with that later. But,
my favorite book when I was about to go into junior high was Basil the Great Mouse Detective.
I've heard of that, but I don't think I read it.
They made it into a cartoon, but the books were awesome when I was like 8.
Yeah, I read Mouse and the Motorcycle.
Yeah.
But he was, again, that's a real mouse. I mean, he's not like a human mouse, you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
Yeah, so. Mice that do intelligent things, animals that do intelligent things, that's okay. But when they walk and
they carry around swords upright, and they walk bipedal, yeah.
Yeah, that's I'm done. Then it's like, no, stop. Yeah. So Tracy's going, what the hell?
So as long as they're tiger people that walk on 2 legs, you're okay with it or no?
No. If they were intelligent tigers.
Okay.
I'm okay with
sure.
it. No, that's cool. Yeah.
So no pinky in the brain for you.
I'm not a big fan. No. I mean, it's funny when he says, you know, trying to take over the world, Pinky. You know, that's funny, you know. And it's different with, I guess, maybe animated cartoons. But when I'm trying to role-play seriously, you know, or, you know, have, I don't know, an immersion experience, if you will, which is kind of a weird way to put that. But then I don't want, talking animals throws it right out for me. It's like,
what
done.
I don't... Oh, go ahead.
No, I'm fine,
I was going to say, what I don't want to know is what Pinky was thinking when he said that burlap chiefs me so.
Yeah, I don't know either.
I don't know. I don't want to know. I love the episode. They had an episode where Paper Mache World, that is the best episode ever.
I wonder if you can get those on Netflix. I liked some of those. Those shows were pretty funny. So.
It's great. Pinky often is the one that has the great idea.
Yeah, that's true.
He did get everybody off to Paper Mache World. Free t-shirts. So that will get everybody on the planet to go down to the Paper Mache World. And then they had to take over a Paper Mache World, because what's the point of taking over Earth if there's no one there?
Good luck finding... Good luck adding this part to the show notes there, Sam.
Oh wait, spoilers, I forgot.
I'll point it to Tracy's website.
Yeah, there you go. I almost created a hate mail account on Gmail the other day.
Oh really?
I almost did. But I don't get hate mail. So I honestly have never gotten, I mean, I've gotten a couple of comments on my blog along the lines of, well, that's awesome, but this is what I did. Which are fine, and people are going to do that. But I've never really gotten anyone that said, and here it comes, see, I'm opening up the floodgates. So some listener right now is like, God damn it, that guy's an ass. I'm just going to, you know, tear into him. And, like, bring it. Come at me, bro.
Send your hate mail to Thad's hate mail at table-4-1.com.
That's right, exactly.
That's why you don't get any, Randall, because we send it all to Thaddeus.
It all goes to Thad, is that why?
That's why, so. Yeah.
Okay, well, I guess that's then, but...
Yeah, I don't really get hate mail. I get hate blog posts. People write blog posts about me. That's awesome.
Yes,
but that's okay.
You're internet famous, and that's why that happens, so...
I know. I'm used to it.
Yeah. I can't imagine how people, like, you know, Will Wheaton or, you know, the guys at Penny Arcade or any of the other guys that are... I mean, Will Wheaton's actually famous as opposed to just internet famous. And so I can't imagine how they deal with that. I guess at some point you just cut it off.
Right. That's what you have publicists for.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, he can afford a publicist, so he has one of those, and they take care of all that crap. But
I know some of them take care of it still themselves. But I don't know either. I think hopefully by the time, you know, a person's reached the level of fame of Will Wheaton now, they've developed the tools for handling it. I'm just trying to learn as I go, so yeah. I don't know if it's the right thing.
Yeah. Please don't sink into a downward spiral of, like, alcohol and, you know, loose women or whatever. So that would be bad. Oh, wait,
I won't have Fred listen to this one, because... He'd be like, that sounds... No, I don't know.
Fred's going, high five, dead orcs, yeah!
Yeah, talking about inappropriate stuff, have you... So are you just Tyler?
Sorry, wait. I just had this image of Fred walking into the house and then having to tweet, hey, I just got home and my house is full of loose women and alcohol.
That'd be pretty awesome.
And you know that somebody on the internet would probably reply with, how is that any different than normal?
Yeah, of course. Yeah. I just can't picture him being like, darn.
Yeah. There's not a lot of guys that would actually go, oh, well, crap.
Anyway, so what's
sorry,
yes.
Go ahead.
There, Aisha Tyler, she's an actress and comedian.
Mm-hmm.
She has a new podcast called Girl on Guy, where she talks about guy topics, because she's really big into video games and some other, like, comics and other...
Oh, people. I've heard of it. I've heard of her, yeah, okay.
Yeah, and she's on the Nerdist recently. I just wanted to say, speaking of inappropriate stuff, she's, if you're not easily offended, she's hilarious to listen to.
So, one for the grown-ups, kids.
Doesn't she travel with the Sexy Liberal show?
You know, I'm not sure.
I think she travels with John Fugelsang and Stephanie Miller on the Sexy Liberal show. They're doing a tour right now.
Now, see, wouldn't it be awesome for us to be so famous that the DM Roundtable could, like, tour?
Wait, you did tour. You toured all the way to Indiana.
We toured to Gen Con and back. That's not a tour. That is not a tour.
I went to DDXP. That's kind of a tour.
Yeah, but we could all, like, get an RV.
Okay. Are we going to shower? I mean...
No. Well, yeah.
Yeah, they have...
Not together. I just meant... I don't... Being in an RV for weeks with people who don't shower, it's just like, I'm sorry, no.
No. You take the RV to different places. It's got your banner on the outside of it, and you, like, park in front of the hotel, and, of course, you stay in the hotel. see.
Yeah, you put a big banner that says DM's gone wild right on the side.
Yes, or something like that, yes.
That is just going to be so sad he misses that this.
I know it. And we're going to give him so many bad ideas.
Yes, we are.
It'll be just like, yeah. You know.
You know, that's going to end up being the name of our panel next year.
I think it'd just be called Full of Liquor and Bad Decisions.
Sign me up.
Nice.
I'm sorry, actually, I stole that from Akewood. Sorry.
Since listening to Aisha's podcast, I've decided to try to relax a little more again so that I'm not so hyper about what I say and how I say it. So, sorry. It's adult now.
Hey,
back to swearing.
You are who you are.
I always put an explicit tag on the podcast. So.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
Very good.
Yeah. Because usually someone comes out with an F-bomb or the shit word or something, you know.
Fucking A, bud.
Yeah, see?
Whoops.
I like how the F word was okay there, but the A word was not.
That's right.
That's because that's one word. That is one word. It's F-U-C-K-I-N-A.
No, it's a hyphenated word.
Oh, is that what it is? Oh, yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Grammar Nazi.
I know. I can't help it. Sorry.
So the other thing that we kind of talked about a little bit on Twitter was how to give basically your villain or your NPC group things that they could use over the in response to what the PCs are doing.
You mean as part of story progression or like during the actual encounter?
Maybe during the actual encounter, but overall as part of story progression. Like, okay. If you're going up against the river rats, right? Of, was it Fall?
Fall Creek.
Yeah.
Fall
Crest.
Fall Creek is a neighborhood in my town, so.
Yeah. Right. Falcon Crest is another thing
yeah,
altogether.
Falcon Crest is, you know, forget it. Dynasty all the way. Anyway, sorry.
I think it's Kelson is the head of that. You
yes.
know, he could be
Kelson,
alive.
Kelson, yes.
With another group as well. And if the PCs don't deal with that alliance, Kelsey could get additional resources over the course of the adventure.
Mm.
Oh, sure. Okay. Yeah.
So the PCs can decide to go for Kelsey right away, or they can decide to go break up that alliance and maybe even convince whoever he was allied with to be allied with them, and then they'd be getting some sort of, you know, we called it a daily power, but it's not really a daily power in the PC sense. It's more of a maybe they have a couple of extra people at a particular encounter, or they're getting
right.
information about what the PCs are doing, or something mm-hmm. like that.
No, well, and it's a great idea too. And actually, you know, dipping into the old school stuff, it's not necessarily an you know, it's an idea that's been around for a while. If you look back at the Village of Hamlet, there are actual incidents in there where if the characters do certain things, and they can gather potential allies.
Right.
Or the bad guys can actually get an advantage. Or if they fail to do something, maybe they get assassins sent after them. So
that,
there's, yeah, I mean.
That happens in the Sinister Secret of Saltmarsh, too.
Exactly.
U1, yeah, because they find out some spoilers. Spoiler alert. But if you haven't read this module by now, okay, it was produced in 1980, all right?
Yeah,
so
really.
This is not really a spoiler, but they find out some stuff about some lizardmen. Some lizard man colony, and they have the option to ally with some people who were previously considered enemies, most likely, or not. So, and it makes a huge difference to the end of the module.
Yeah. So yeah, it's a good idea. Yeah, I think that more adventures should probably do things like that, and I hope they're going in that direction. So.
Yeah, I think it'd be
yeah.
really cool.
Yeah.
Because I didn't
so
get to
what,
play the old school stuff, but
what spawned like, that conversation? Is there an actual like WotC article or?
No, it was partly because I finished the Erebus Kale trilogy.
Mm-hmm.
And I noticed that as things were going along, both the PCs and the NPCs were reacting to each other and gaining in resources. Like
cool.
I know I use PC and NPC, but. The heroes of the story and the protagonists
mm-hmm.
Or antagonists were you know, they're going through this crescendo. And that seemed cooler to me than some of the 4E adventures where it's static. And that's one of the things we've been talking a lot about, how to make 4E less static. The decisions you make in roleplay or in other ways feed back into the adventure in an easy manner so that you're not doing a ton of prep. And that's one of the nice things, like, you know, you can introduce complications as part of a daily power, you know, or things like that. But at the same time, I'm not always comfortable with, like, how much of that stuff to add in. Like, I could really use some guidelines sometimes for how much to add in. And that's why I wanted to bring it into an actual discussion rather than saying, because right now DMs are just told to do whatever they think feels good. But
well, and you know what, though, Tracy? I'm not sure that advice is totally off track too much, because I don't know if there's a way to easily codify that. I think that each game, the players are different. Players that are really involved in the game setting who are going to key in to those kinds of relationships are going to find them interesting and they're going to pursue those kinds of things. But like my players, they might go, oh, okay, but they're not going to, it's not going to impact them in the same way. And so I'm not going to have that style of game for them because it's not going to, it'll be a lot of extra effort on my part for really no reward.
Well, and you wouldn't have to codify it or make it a part of every game, but the fact that there's nothing right now to help people learning how to do it, or maybe even bring up the topic, makes it hard for people who are new to the game.
Oh, and I agree. And one or two examples of how it can be used, both in an intense way and in a very light way, would be very useful to have. That would be nice to have. You're right about that. Yeah.
I feel like I cut Sam off.
No, I was just listening.
Okay.
I agree. I think that the word codify is so strange, right? Because as soon as you say codify, it immediately conjures images of tables and charts on the, you know, in the DMG and on the Dungeon Master screen, and right. You know, like a skill challenge chart with the difficulty rating and, you know, blah blah blah. But codify in terms of, you know, just give some sort of direction to, you know, it really needs a how-to. It needs a, here's the basics of the issue. Here's why it's important to maybe add this to your game. Here are the signs. Here's what to look for in your players.
Right.
To recognize whether they're digging this or, they don't really care about it. And if they don't really care about it, you know, how do you determine if it's because... maybe, you know, especially if you're a new DM, I know when I was a new DM, it was like, well, am I not presenting this right? Or am I, you know, so how to tell whether they're not digging it because you're not presenting it right? Or, although there's no right or wrong, okay, but you know what I mean, right? You're not presenting it the best way possible or in a way that they understand. Or are they really just not digging it because they really just don't dig it? Like Randall's right. saying yeah. his players do. So, you know, there's a lot of stuff out there that, you know, when you have a system and you just say, well, you know, you have to learn your group and learn how to read your group. Well, that's easy for Randall and I who've been role-playing for 30 years. But when you haven't been doing that, or maybe you've been role-playing for 4 or 5 years, which is a substantial amount of time, but you've never DM'd, you know, and then you start DMing and it's like all of a sudden it's way different, right? It's like, oh, I'm supposed to pay attention to all my players and I have to know when they're paying attention and what they're enjoying, what they're not, and how do I find that out?
Yeah.
And how do I know that they're enjoying it for this particular new awesome thing that I'm throwing in, or they're not? And so it needs both kinds of guidelines, like help how to determine if your group really is going to enjoy this that you're throwing in there and working on and spending a lot of energy on, or, you know, and then it needs the part of here's how to actually do it mechanically. Here's how to sort of figure out if what you're doing is going to be way too overwhelming, like – If your players ally with Group B, does that mean that when they go to confront the leader of Group A now and they have all the Group B on their side, oh, it's just going to be this big gang fight, but it's two gangs against one, so there's just going to be this overwhelming ambush, and it's really not exciting because your players are just kind of standing there and Group B is fighting Group A and big deal. You know, that's not really exciting. They want to be involved and in it and figuring out, you know, they don't want to just stand there and watch a big gang fight, because you could watch TV if you're going to do that. You don't need to play a role-playing game.
Well, and I think that the DM guide does a good job of explaining the different types of players out there, but it doesn't tie it into that missing piece, which is, okay, I've got all this information on the different kinds of players and stuff, but how do I make that work
right.
in the kind of game that I want to mm-hmm. build? And I'm not sure right. that information is really as clear as it could be.
No. At least in my opinion, it's not.
Oh, and I agree with you. Yeah.
And that's one of the things, is, and some people are like, well, you're never going to learn that from a book, you're only going to learn from DMing. I'm like, well, yeah, you know, I DM as it is, but I can... Like, even if I played once a week, I'm only going to get 52 games in a year. Mm-hmm. You know, I may not do it as well, but at least be exposed to this variety of ideas and try to pick and choose where I decide to do those tests and those experiments would help tremendously, instead of, you know, trying to figure out what I might change on top of figuring out how to change it.
Right.
And just in my opinion, and that doesn't work for everyone. I just happen to be the type of person who, if I read something, I'm much more likely to remember it than if I hear it, or, you know, if it's a passing thought while I'm running. And this sort of thing. Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
No, I was just finish your thought. I'm sorry.
I was just gonna say one of the things I did like about Adventure Burner in the demo scenario they gave, they did try to give a lot of this information about. You know, how to run it and why it was important to do things a certain way, which I really liked. Even if I don't necessarily play Burning Wheel, seeing how they broke it down would help me, I think, break down other things in other games.
Well, I know that just seeing words in print gives them weight. I mean, it's okay to talk to a bunch of learned gamers and say, well, this is how I've been doing it for years or whatever, I like this method, blah, 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 picking and choosing from the wisdom that you have. But when you actually see the words in print and saying, we found that this works well, it adds weight to it. And so you're going to tend to buy it, if you will. Now, not some people will read that and say, well, that's crap, I'm never going to do that. And that's going to happen. But again, just the very fact that they're in print adds weight to it. So,
right.
Yeah.
And the thing is I can run my game for a home group as much as I want, but it's not going to help me when I DM at a convention and I meet someone for the first time who has a totally different outlook on gaming than I do. If I have a sort of an idea of what might appeal to that type of gamer, that's going to help me tremendously, even if I'm not great at it when I do it. I'm already, I think, in my opinion, a step ahead. But
no, I think you're right. I mean, one of the things that's helped me is that one of the guys that's in my game group is a DM himself for the game that I'm playing in.
Nice.
And so he's been trying out a lot of the house rules that I've started. And so I can get to see those from the player side. And there's been one or two that's like, yeah, that never worked out really, did it? Because let's not do that. So, and I go, huh. Or we'll, you know, like, for example, I mean, and this is actually a good example of something that is working, is the extended rest rules that I started on as house rules. They actually have to roll on it based on their condition and what they have with them. They have to roll an endurance check to during their extended rest to get the full benefit of their extended rest. And if they fail that endurance check, then depending upon the conditions they're in or how bad the conditions they're in, it can be less. You might lose healing surges, or you might not have access to daily powers the next day, that kind of thing. And he started using the same system, and it's like, we're taking an extended rest, and he goes, okay, roll those endurance checks. It's like, oh crap, we really have to do that, don't we? So, but it's working out well, so, you know, that's a good thing. But that back and forth feedback is actually kind of nice to have. So, and of course, Anna tells me a lot of stuff as a player that other players may not have, not necessarily the courage, but, you know, out of politeness or whatever, don't want to say. And Anna will come up and say, that totally sucks, you know? It's like, you're taking too long, or why did the setup do this, or whatever, you know? So it's like, oh, okay, well, I can improve that, you know, that kind of stuff. So,
right.
Yeah.
It's not always so easy to get feedback.
No.
You know, in fact, it's probably easier to get feedback at a con if you take a form to have your players spend the last 5 or 10 minutes filling out, you know, than it is to get feedback from your home group that you play with, you know, once or twice a month, or once a week or whatever, you know, because they, you know, the problem is that they don't want to hurt your feelings, probably, because you're friends. But also, they also don't want you to, like...
Stop DMing?
To stop DMing. But they also, the thing is, though, that a lot of people are, they don't want you to really change because they also want you to be happy. And they just assume you're happy the way that you're running the game. So some of them are afraid if they complain about something that you may change it, but then you're going to be bitter because you had to change something that you really liked. You know what I mean? So, and then that would affect the game. So there's this huge, weird, you know, dynamic. And so it's not always easy to get feedback because lots of times people just don't want to hurt your feelings. Yeah. But, you know, sometimes you need to hear, yeah, that didn't work. That sucked. Don't do that again. Or sometimes you need to hear that, but then you get to think about, you know, the reasons why. Okay, well, why did that suck? And do I just get rid of it all the way, or do I just change it a little bit? Because maybe it really sucked, but only you know, for part of it. Maybe at first it was really working. And so what are the reasons for that? You know, or right. Do I need to change it to make it work? Because a lot of times, you know, you can't just throw something out. You can't just throw anything out whole cloth, because then there's usually a hole there and you have to do something to take care of it.
Right.
No, I think you're right. Yeah, I mean...
You know, the other thing about having something written down is that even if a person has lots of experience and they read something and they completely dismiss it, they still read that.
It's
somewhere in the back of their mind. And there may be a case where they end up in a situation where that little nugget that was waiting back in their brain seeps into what they actually do and how they react to a particular situation, whether they do it consciously or not. So, you know, I'm sort of with Tracy on this one. It's all fine to say, well, you know, it relies upon you knowing your group and you have to really understand the dynamic and blah, blah, blah. Yeah, that's all true. I get that. I'm not disputing that. However, when you have something written down, it's really good for people to read it. And it starts being a pervasive part of the system. And just like anything else, any DM can decide to not use it if they don't want to, but it has the possibility to change the way that games are run and the way the system is perceived.
Yeah.
Well, the grand experiment I'm getting ready to run over the next few months will be real telling in this. So, because the campaign style is going to change. I mean, I've been running, prepared modules since the beginning of this particular 4E group, and we're now switching to stuff that's, although it's built on an established property, it's my own material, and I'm adding things to it. And so I'm hoping that this will it's a little bit of change of pace. It's less combat intensive, so.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, I mean, anyone who's ever played Myst knows that it's, you know, it's a game about puzzles, it's about immersion. And it's not about, you know, combat. There's not a single combat in the entire game. So I have to throw in some of those elements so that the players will be satisfied that there is some of that going on, which is interesting in itself because you have to come up with creatures that fit into the setting. And it's like, what would happen if this puzzle didn't work out like it should? What kind of things might happen? So a lot of the monster encounters, spoiler alert to any of my players that may be listening to this, it's going to be what kinds of things. I mean, the monsters will be reactionary. In other words, if something doesn't go right, the monster is going to come. You know what I'm saying? So it'll be interesting to see how this works out.
This is one of those things where fourth edition has caught a lot of flack because. And whether you agree or not, I'm just going to say what the complaint is. The complaint is, of course, 4E is too combat focused. Mm-hmm. But that's not the real problem. The real problem is 4E has a lot of combat focus and it's not very deadly. Okay, yeah. Now I know a lot of people don't agree with that. That's fine. Okay, I'm not purporting it as the ultimate truth. I'm just saying that's one complaint. Mm-hmm. Okay, and it was true, for, at least for me, early on in the system. With Essentials, it's a little better, but... It's still – there is some of that depending on how you run your game. Okay, so if you have a system that's really combat-focused but not deadly, you end up with this pervasive attitude, and almost every group will go towards this because it just happens because you get – adapted to the way that the game runs, and you get you have expectations about that system now. And what happens is the people assume they're going to win the fight because it's always they win the fight. And if they don't win the fight, it's because some weird thing happened. Either the dice really turned on them, or you know there was something unexpected, or someone made a couple of really dumb tactical moves in a row, or whatever. Right? There's always a reason. It's some exception of a reason why that happened, versus what the rule is, which is everybody always survives. Okay, mm-hmm. But that's actually very different from first edition and basic. Okay, because in first and basic, it wasn't really. You didn't have a so let me sort of take another tangent here real quick. One of the great things about 4E is also one of the things that I kind of have a problem with, and that is that you can take any creature and make it any level. So you can have a third level beholder. You can say, oh, there's a baby beholder, you know.
Right.
Or you can have a 30th level, 33rd level beholder who is this massive giant eye tyrant world eater, okay? Mm-hmm. I think it's awesome on one hand. And on the other hand, I don't want a third level beholder, because in first edition and basic, if you saw a beholder and you were, you know, a very low level, you turn around and and then you died, right, of fright,
yeah.
Okay, because you knew that that thing was going to kill you because there was no hope. And so there was a lot more caution and let me see what's around this corner because I don't want to come face to face with, you know, a purple worm because I know I'm dead if I do that. And yet if I sneak, we can find a way around it, you know. Right. Or if our cleric has used all of his turning spells and I look around the corner and I see ghouls, I'm going the other way. Even though we may still be able to defeat them because we're powerful, but we don't have turning spells and it just might not go our way, so we're going to find a way around. And so the result was that you had a lots of avoidance and retreating. And you almost never have that in 4th edition. I know that's a topic that's been discussed before, but this is one of the things – one of the reasons it does that is because you have this pervasive thought of everybody's going to survive. And then you also have the – you can have a 3rd level Balrog. Okay? You can have a 3rd level Beholder.
Well,
you can have a 5th level Purple Worm.
I think the reason for that is that they traded that kind of obscurity for even math, essentially.
Mm-hmm. Oh, sure,
and
yeah.
I think that's where it comes from. I think there are ways to get around that, and I think you'd agree. I mean, you're only stating what the complaint is, and I agree with you there.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I'm not even – yeah, it's not even my personal complaint, actually.
No, mine
either. I think that's one of the things that happens, though. And people get used to the way a system is. And so what happens is you end up not – sort of focusing on how to role play and have these choices that we're talking about, like group A and group B are allied, and you can really only defeat the one that you want to defeat or overcome if you break that alliance and ally with the other group yourself, or at least break the alliance, right? There might be 3 levels, right? You either don't break the alliance and you're really, it's going to be tough, or you break the alliance and it's the second level of slightly less tough but still hard, or you break the alliance and you ally with the other team and now it's a little bit easier. And that's really awesome, but it's something that hasn't been really focused on because, well, you know, we always win all our battles, so.
Right. There's no reason to go outside of the combat thing because the social contract that is put in the DMGs is that you're going to be able, and you're not really going to come across an encounter that you can't beat if you're good at it.
Right. It's meant to be challenging, but not deadly.
Right.
Depending on your level. Right. And so in any way, all this to say, to wrap this back around to what Randall's talking about, is that's going to be a tough transition for you, for your party. For your group of players.
And it will be. And there's one of the things that I've always given the expectation up front, and that's that, look, the story is the most important. Can people die? Yes. And I make that clear. People can die. Does that mean it's the end of you at the table? I say no. And so there may be already some expectations like, well, my character isn't really going to die. Something will happen. And that's fine. But it's about willing suspension of disbelief. So and I wouldn't expect to play like this at a convention at all. I mean, my home game is very specially tuned to the folks that I'm playing with. So that's going to be different than like whatever you want to call system neutral or whatever. But I think, though, that it's possible, even in 4E, to totally utilize DM caveat and not make yourself out to be a dick.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's, and the nice thing about it is the game can allow you to do that in subtle ways where the players, and a big DM spoiler here, look behind the curtain or the screen, if you will, is like, yeah, if I want to make that at will an encounter, I mean that encounter power an at will, you're damn right well I will, just to make the encounter more challenging and to progress the story. I'm not going to try to do it arbitrarily to screw my players because I'm not a killer DM. That's what we in the old school. That was what they were called, killer DMs. They didn't care what you did. I mean, you could be all powerful. The DM would still say lightning bolts from heaven, boom, you're dead. And because and the game let you do that. It was just you're done.
Well, this is one of the reasons for the balance that they strove for in fourth edition is that not only to balance all the character classes so that no one there was no flip-flop, right? It used to be that fighters were very powerful at low levels and magic users were killed by house cats. And then but at high levels it switched where fighters really couldn't do anything because if the mage the enemy mage, villain mage, whatever looked at them, they would be paralyzed.
Right.
So, you know, and so to get rid of that, but also to get rid of the sort of DM fiat killer DM syndrome, which surprise, surprise, isn't really fun all the time. Yeah, it maybe in an isolated way, if you know you're sitting down to a con game or something like, you know, there's a Tower of Gygax thing where the whole thing, the whole point of it is to just go through and survive as long as you can because you know you're going to die.
Right.
Okay. And but that's sort of it's a given. It's part of the rules of that
that's
particular
a, that's
way
specialized
to play.
Play. Yeah,
right.
That's a
exactly.
Way to play.
Right.
Yeah.
But you don't want that in your home campaign.
No.
And your players will walk out. So they figure that out, and they've been sort of striving for that. And so 4E does that really well. They make it, and at the same time for the DM, it's more transparent than any other edition about how to create monsters and encounters. It's not perfectly 100%. Yeah, any newbie can pick it up and be perfect, but. Compared to other editions, it's wonderful.
Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah, it makes DMing much easier than even 3.5. And I started really DMing at 3.5. And or, I mean, at 3. Well, whatever, that whole set. Mm-hmm. That yeah. But I mean, the big secret here, guys, is that regardless of the edition you're playing, yeah, the DM can still kill you.
Right.
He doesn't need rules to do that. And so the people that say, well, my players' characters can never die, it's like, oh, yeah, they can. You make them die.
Yeah.
And it's – so it's sort of – you know, to me the argument – yes, mathematically playing – and I know Tracy will hate this expression, but as the rules are written
–
I know you hate that expression. But, yeah, or out of the box or whatever – you want to call it.
I have a good example of this when you get done with your thought, Randall.
Yeah, your math is correct, Sam, and you're right. On mathematically, it's hard to play as it's written. But if you're playing in the spirit of it, you kill whatever characters you want to progress the story. That's the way it works.
Well, actually, I'm not entirely sure it's true that math-wise, it's going to – I think – what was it, like a PC, a tier or something – that would probably die math-wise. So the big thing is that the math expects there to be something between 3 and 6 encounters before each extended rest.
But, right. But
that's correct, yeah.
That is right. But what ended up happening, and this is why I had issues when I first started, I think I've said this on the podcast before, is, you know, I was really not good at keeping the encounters to a minimal time. And so we would end up with like one encounter, maybe two encounters per session, and then they would rest in between. So you instead of getting 3 to 6, you'd get 1 or 2.
But that's what I'm saying is that according to the math, like if you actually follow all of their guidelines, you could fairly easily kill some characters.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But nobody follows that because it doesn't make sense story-wise to go through 3 to 5 combat encounters in one 24-hour period.
Yeah, well, and that's why I implemented the rules for extended rests too.
Right.
I wanted to give some kind of illusion that you know it's tough. You're in a place that you're not in a comfortable bed in your home or your inn. You're sleeping on the ground. There's rats or concrete, or not concrete, but stone, or there's, you know, the constant threat of danger, or there's flaming lava in a pool next to you or something. You can't just sleep wherever the hell you want and get the rest benefit that you think you're going to get. Mm-hmm. And so that was the whole idea.
That used to actually be in the rules, though, too, in a way. It was sort of one of those almost unspoken things. It was mentioned in a few things like you can't sleep in your armor. Or
right.
you can.
In the old days. In the
right,
old
but,
rules, yeah.
But you're not going to sleep as well because you can't rest well in heavy plate mail.
Right, exactly.
But rarely did we ever – I mean, so from my own play experience, just from my group – I can't even think of one time when we sat down to rest for the evening, our paladin said, "Yes, I'm taking off all my plate mail." You know, you just didn't do it.
Yeah.
And if there was an attack that night, you know, you just all jumped up and you all just had all your equipment and all your armor on. I mean, it's just, that's just what you did.
And I think I could have swore in the 4E DMG, there were spots where it said for extreme environmental conditions that you wouldn't necessarily be able to rest and get all of your healing surges and stuff back.
I think that's true. Yeah, it mentions it, but I think it does things like it says, you know, use the plus or the plus two or minus two circumstance bonus.
There's healing
for
surge
different
drops.
Checks and stuff. Are there? Okay.
If you're like in a heavy desert and you don't have the, you know, you haven't had enough water, etc., or shelter.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, you definitely begin to lose.
Yeah.
But I think you get your dailies back still.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but see, I even said, you know, I figure, and this is in my own thinking, and this is my own interpretation of the way powers work, and that's that. The more powerful a power is, dailies or your encounters, the more energy, the more training it's taken to perfect that situation. Maybe your concentration has to be just so to be able to do that daily. And, you know, if you're thrown off by bad environment, strange locations, things like that, then, you know, maybe you don't have that concentration to be able to pull off a daily that day. So, you know, that's my own interpretation. You know, your mileage will vary, but, that's kind of how I'm reading those kind of things. So, but good stuff, good topic.
So my example of the DM fiat thing and how it could go good or bad. So I'm running this basic D&D game, red box game, basically on a play by post forum game. And they're almost to the actual place where they're going to start entering this dungeon. And they rested one night, and I rolled for wandering monsters. Or actually, they woke up in the morning, and I rolled for their morning wandering monster. And for once, it came up with, you know, there's a wandering monster here. And so I'm like, okay, well, this is new, because normally it doesn't, because it's only a 1 out of 12 chance or whatever. So I roll the die, and they're in a mountainous area, and it comes up a dragon. And they're level 1 characters. So then, you know, you roll on the dragon table, and it's a gold dragon. So I'm like, oh, okay. Well, it's an intelligent dragon. It speaks 90% of the time, whatever. So they meet this dragon, and now they're having this conversation. Well, here's the thing. They just pissed off the dragon, okay? So by DM fiat, my response could be, because basically he said, you passed through my mountain range, and you didn't pay penance to me. You didn't pay the fee. So you owe me. What are you going to do for me? And so they sang for him, and they played some music, and he didn't like it, so he asked for something more up-tempo. And so they played something else, and he wasn't all that thrilled about it. And
not
so
a fan
he,
of light jazz.
He asked him, well, you know, because we're role-playing, right? So then he basically says, tell me where you're going, because I want to know what your adventure is, and then I'm going to make – you can bring back something for me. And one of the dwarves gets upset, and he basically mouths off and says, what do you mean? You're supposed to be this big, powerful dragon. You could go get it yourself. And that actually – so I said, okay, that's either going to really piss off the dragon, or it's going to make the dragon laugh because it's so preposterous, right? Because dragons are very, like, at least in basic D&D, they're very – especially gold dragons, okay? They're super intelligent. You know, humans are peons, right? They're so below the level of a dragon. So yeah. So I randomly determine whether he smiles at that or frowns at that. he turns out he smiles. So he laughs at the dwarf, and he basically says, you know, basically, puny human, you're stupid, you know, kind of thing. But then he says, you need to do this for me because I'm telling you. And if I was going to go get the treasure myself, I wouldn't need you, which means you'd be lunch. Now, which would you prefer?
See, okay. I might even have gotten a little mean there, and like as he laughed, this like part of his breath came out and like did some damage.
Well, so what happened was, because it's a play by post, so I sort of wrote all this descriptive stuff about how saliva was dripping from his mouth, and he got really close to the dwarf's head, and when the saliva dropped to the ground, they could see steam coming off of it, and he was breathing his hot breath on the dwarf, and he had these huge, sparkly, shiny teeth, and you know, so I mean, I really embellished it, right?
Right.
But I could have just basically said, you know, he takes a bite out of the dwarf.
Sounds like you're writing slash fiction to me.
And that's really how it was in basically Indeed. Like, it's completely up to me. I didn't even have to roll. When I did the, oh, he's either going to laugh or he's going to be mad, I rolled. That was just something I made up. That's not a mechanic.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
Sure. I just said, okay, there's probably a 50-50 chance right now because he really does look upon them as puny, you know, demi-humans. And I rolled it, and it turns out he's in a good mood today, you know? But, I mean, it's total diem fiat. I could say, oh, he opens his mouth and breathes on you while you're dead.
Right. And I think there's the heart of role-playing right there. I mean, that's what makes it – that's what separates it from something like a board game.
Right.
Is that you can diverge – I mean, the whole idea is to take the rules as a framework. And I think we forget that sometimes. And so many heated discussions, I was like, oh, my God.
Yeah.
And I sit there and watch, and it's just like, guys – framework.
Well, so the whole thing
it's
is
not all
this,
yeah.
But my point is sort of this is why fourth edition has so many rules about combat type stuff. Because you really need in order to not have a bunch of people, because you know, I'm sorry to say it, but back in the day there were a bunch of people that would have just said, okay, he breathes on you, you're dead. Whoops, oh, too bad I rolled a 12 on the D12. You get a wandering monster, whoops, it's a dragon, he comes and kills you. That's it, end of adventure. Let's start over, make new characters. And it's like, okay, that's not fun. Yeah. But lots of people were like that. And so to get away from that, 4th edition, and 2nd and 3rd to some extent, of course, but 4th edition specifically really has worked on making that not really an option. Now, it's still, like Randall said earlier, Dirty DM Secret, it's still an option because you can do whatever you want. But it's much less, you know, taught to DMs that that's okay. Whereas it used to be just be, oh, that's what you do.
What's kind of funny is this leads into the topic, because I remember now, Randall, what we wanted to talk about, and that is war.
After an hour.
What is it good for? Absolutely nothing. Say it again.
Because we were talking...
Go ahead, Tracy.
We were talking on Twitter about how... like, at least you and I, and I know a few other people chimed in, played their version of war as kids.
Where yes, yes, yes.
Okay. Oh, make-believe war? Like cowboys, yes. Indians? I did too.
Yeah. And we were wondering if this led to a lot of people ended up playing RPGs, because, I mean, one of the biggest fights, at least in our game, is always, I shot you, no you didn't.
Mm. Yeah, no, it missed. It just nicked my arm.
You didn't even see me.
Yeah. No, you shot before I stood up.
Your finger wasn't even pointing right. Uh-huh. Yeah, it's like you're pointing way over there.
Yeah.
Oh, you're right. And Tracy, you're absolutely right. And I think that, and what's funny is that it hasn't changed in the entire generation. Let me give you an example. When I was a kid, we played war a lot all the time, and we never shot anything physical at each other. We had toy guns and stuff, but we were just, you know, bang, bang, and things like that. And we had these – it was like this sort of – we all came up with the rules at the same time. It wasn't a traditional game of tag because it wasn't like that, but it was just – we sort of knew what the rules were. It was almost like a hive mind kind of a thing. Mm-hmm. You all get together and you say, this is how we play this game. And and of course, we would have some things like dirt clod fights and stuff out at where the construction zones and things were at, but we didn't tell our parents about those.
Right.
And, you know, because, you know, until some kid got beamed in the head and, you know, you got to get stitches or whatever. But,
yeah,
you know, that didn't happen too often because, you know, one of the unwritten rules was, hey, you don't aim for the head.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, unless there's a broken bone, ain't nobody snitching on the fact that we're out where we're not supposed to be.
Right. So, but now, I mean, my own kids, my teenagers, now they play a lot of, I'm trying to remember what, airsoft.
Mm.
They have airsoft guns, mm-hmm. which shoot the little plastic BBs.
Yeah.
Oh, nice.
And they run around out back. We live on a, for lack of a better word, a culvert. I call it my urban stream. But it's, you know, it's a nice grassy with trees, and it's a culvert, though. It's essentially a huge storm drain is what it is that goes down. But it's all, I mean, it's grass except for the small part that's the culvert. Well, they run up and down all these duplexes, and they play airsoft. And so it's, but they have their own sets of rules, too. And, in fact, they even carry around melee weapons, foam melee weapons as well. And so it's like this huge LARP going on out in my backyard.
Right.
And but it's basically the same. I mean, it's the same kind of stuff we did. And they just come up with it. They didn't write anything down.
No.
They just, you know, you just come up with it. And I think those kinds of things helped ease me into, you know, role-playing. Because, and we actually thought, oh, hey, there is kind of a rule for this. That's cool. We eliminate an argument.
Yes.
Yeah, probably spawned 400 more arguments. But...
Well, that's because there was always the older brother or older kid in the neighborhood who pulled rank, or the one who won on Monday because they had some rule and everybody agreed to it, and then on Tuesday, the rule suddenly didn't apply to him anymore.
Yeah.
So, you know, it changed. There was always the one kid that did that in my neighborhood.
In our group of friends, we had the one kid, and I feel terrible about this, he just didn't have a great home life and life in general, mm-hmm. so he played D&D with my brother, too, and it was always about, he was a power gamer, he wanted to win, he wanted to be strong, mm-hmm. so he was the guy that never got hit, even though it's like, dude, three of us were quote-unquote shooting at you. Like,
yeah.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, that's the only place you could have control, but that's a
right.
different topic. But yeah.
Oh yeah, yeah. But though, yeah. but coming up with rules and stuff, you know, mm-hmm. kind of helps with that because at least then it should be arbitrary. We were just on the cusp of like laser tag was just coming out when mm-hmm. I was little, so I think if we had been a few years younger, it would have been even cooler. But we had a lot of fun. The Super Soakers with the dye also came out.
Yeah, see, I was already an adult and had children by the time those came out, so they're fun. I've used them, but they're
They didn't work as well as you'd think. My parents were always my mom was always afraid the dye was not actually going to come out, and then the range was so limited as to be useless. You might as well just go up and hit each other. Mm. So I wish we had the foam weapons because that would have been cool. We weren't allowed to play with the sticks.
Right.
So my dad was so awesome. He was a big woodworker, and so basically, he would make us whatever we wanted. So we had like these big wooden guitars, not stringed or anything. Like he would just because we could horse around, and of course none of us could play guitar, but we had these big guitars. We had swords. We had shields. You know, my dad was awesome like that.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. We never really had. I mean, we just kind of made do with what we had, but we missed all of the cool. I mean, BB guns. Were out because, you know, you could hurt somebody seriously with those, so we weren't allowed to use those.
Yeah.
And they didn't really have airsoft. Yeah, they had plastic BB stuff, but it was crappy, and it never, you know, you'd shoot like 2 feet, and it would just, like, you know, wouldn't do anything. But all the cool projectile weapons, like Nerf and stuff like that, happened after I, you know, became an adult, so...
Oh, yeah, I mean, by the time all that stuff was out,
fights.
I was playing paintball, you know?
Yeah, I'm too much of a pussy for paintball, I can't do it. I can't. I won't do it. It's just like one of my oldest did it, and he came back black and blue. And it's like, yeah, I'm not going to do that. Why subject my body to that? I'm not going to do that. but yeah, I mean, but in college though, we did have the Nerf guns had come out by then, and we were having Nerf ball fights, Nerf gun fights, like in the basement and stuff, and those were a blast.
Yeah.
So, but I guess what I'm coming around to is that this whole idea of everyone just kind of getting to know the rules all at the same time, just coming up with it and kind of just intuitively knowing what's expected, sort of happens at my game table as well. And I think that really can only happen with an established game group necessarily. I mean, a bunch of strangers, maybe that's not going to happen right off. I mean, if they become a regular game group, sure. But And that's why I think a lot of these kinds of rules issues aren't as big of a deal for established game groups, is because they've gotten to that point where, well, this is the established way that we're doing things. And then they can train new people that come into the group and say, okay, this is how we do it. And if you don't like that, you're not in the group. You know, it's kind of like that, you know. And so, I mean, that sounds kind of cliquish, and maybe it is, but that's sort of the kind of, you know, if you want to play with our group, if you like hanging out with us people, then these are the rules you need to play, you know.
Well, there's a difference between being just a total douchebag for no reason and being a person who wants to surround themselves with cool people that are of like mind at the same game table.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, you know, I don't care if it's cliquish or elitist or whatever, but if a guy sits down at my table and starts spewing racist crap, he's out. I'm sorry.
Well, yeah.
You know?
Exactly.
I mean, but things that aren't as major or as big a deal to others as that, you know, still could be, you know, if someone does something that bothers one of the other players, then they get a talking to.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Oh, well, I had to call down on one of my players for, he was using the term rape a lot.
Mm.
And it was like, you know, dude, no, we need to chill out.
Yeah.
I go, it was starting to make Anna uncomfortable. And Anna's hardly offended by anything. It's like, when it's starting to make Anna uncomfortable, you need to stop. And he was cool about it, you know. He was cool about it. He goes, yeah, you're probably right. And I go, yeah, I mean, it's cool. I'm saying, I mean, we all say stuff we probably shouldn't say. So, you know.
Right.
And so, you know, he's still in the game group and he's my DM and it's all good. But, you know, it's just you have to be able to communicate. You have to be, and I hate to use this word, but you have to be mature about it, you know? And if you're not going to be willing to do that, then maybe there's something else you need to be doing instead. So.
Yeah.
Old man wisdom, guys. There you go.
Did you read the Robbers Creek thing? I forget. The kids, there was a psychology study.
Yes, I read that when you posted it. That was an excellent article. I loved
that.
What
was that?
I think it's called Robbers Creek or something like that.
A Robbers Cave.
Robbers Cave.
Yeah, Robbers Cave. Yeah. Basically a Boy Scout camp where they separated two groups of boys, did not tell the other group that the other group was there in the same camp, so they were isolated. It was a very large piece of land. Okay, so it's like a Boy Scout outdoor camp. And basically a whole Lord of the Flies things went down. I mean, they eventually discovered that the other group existed by, you know, seeing stuff on trails and things like that. And eventually the counselors got them together for a ball game. But at that point, they had so demonized the other team or the other group that it started to get ugly. And they actually had to separate and prevent, I mean, mascots were being stolen and burned in effigy and all kinds of weird crap. And the counselors who were also doing the study had to finally step in. Am I shortcutting this okay, Tracy? I'm not leaving out anything.
Well, there's one thing that I want to talk about with it, but this is cool too.
But the long and short of it is that, you know, they each group, in order to feel better amongst themselves, would demonize the other group, largely by calling names. Of course, this was the early 1950s, so, you know, people still had a certain amount of a level of how to put it anyway. But they
weren't calling them fucking a-holes.
No, probably not. And they didn't go into details as to what kind of name calling they were doing.
Right.
But that was a large part of it. But they were doing other things as well. And that was to make themselves feel better within the group. Mm-hmm. And it was just, it was an interesting study. If Tracy's, she's linked it. So when you get a chance, Sam, read that, because it's a really interesting study.
So one of the other parts of it, though, was they took the boys and they made the two groups of 12. And the adults were there to make sure nothing really went wrong, but they didn't direct the boys in any way. So these groups had to create their own culture. So part of the study was to see how culture was developed. And they would do that, like, just because they would elect somebody, they would pick somebody to be the first person to do the dishes, and let's say. And however that person did it set for the future how most of the other people did it. It created precedent right away. And that kind of can happen in our own gaming groups, you know. For whatever reason, we might decide that during roleplay we'll go left to right, starting with whoever's the tallest. Or we always start with Bob, and we just do it the once, maybe twice, and then suddenly it's how we do it, and we never think about it after that.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're right. Those kinds of things, yeah, they happen that way. Yeah. It's a fascinating study, so if you get a chance to read it, all you out there and listeners, all you listeners.
I'm just still surprised they gave knives out as rewards. Like, I'm not that surprised, but on the other hand.
Not for Boy Scouts. In fact, even nowadays, if they're teenagers, they're like pocket knives or whatever, I could see that as being.
Oh, yeah, but after you've already seen these hostilities start to develop, I would not be given knives.
Well, but yeah, it was a lot different the way that you could do in a study like this back then.
Oh yeah.
Well, look at the prison experiment or whatever. Yeah. I mean, that was pretty brutal, and I can't believe they got away with that either. Well, but it was for those very kinds of events that the rules that exist now exist because horrible human abuses. So
it was funny. I guess they described it somewhere. I forget where I read it. That some of the boys that got knives, because they gave out medals and knives, and some of the boys that got the knives with they would get it, they would kiss it, and then quickly secret it away on their on their body so that nobody else could take it. But like that started to get a little different.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. So.
Hmm.
So I know some of us had stuff we had to do. Do we want to wrap up, or I can't think of anything else right now to talk about?
Not off the top of my head. And did we want to take questions? Not worry about it tonight.
We've been recording for, well, it's 11 o'clock, and we started right around 9:30.
Okay.
So this is already going to be like an hour and 15 minutes.
Okay.
So
Tracy, what are you working on that you can talk about?
What I can talk about? I don't know. I've been kind of slacking. Like, I've been really busy and doing a lot of stuff, but a lot of it is my regular day job is just killing my mind at work at night, so I haven't been in writing.
Yeah.
I've been reading more than I've been writing, which is sometimes a good thing.
Sam?
I have a similar issue to Tracy in that I am in the last year of my PhD. And so there's this saying amongst grad students and advisors, or maybe not a saying, but a sort of well-known phenomenon, and that is that the last year of your degree is when everything gets done. And that doesn't mean that that's when you're finishing up. It means that you start and finish a lot of things at that time, because it's probably the most clarity in terms of what you need to do to be complete. And so therefore you have to rush around and get all of that set up and done. And so I'm sort of in the swing of that right now. And so I have not even gamed in forever. Basically all my games have been on hiatus for the summer. And there's one online game that I'm a player in and not a GM that I still can maintain because I'm a player, so there's no prep work for the most part. It's tough. I know, cry for me. Not that bad. I mean, my life is great. It sounds horrible in terms of gaming, but my life is great. And in the next 6 or 8 months, I'll be getting done and I'll be able to actually devote time to my favorite hobby. So yeah.
Since you're a grad student, do you drive a Karmann Ghia?
No, I drive a Ford Explorer because it's paid off.
Oh,
and,
okay. Oh, that's
I did
the bill.
Yeah, I did field work for my master's. I did a master's at a different school, so I was doing that, I did field work, so I needed a heavy duty truck. So that's what I got.
Because I know a lot of grads. I guess like the official grad student car is the Karmann Ghia. So, yeah.
not in snowy Ithaca.
No, probably right. Yeah, that's true. Good point.
Yeah.
Well, I'm not doing. I mean, I was telling Tracy earlier. I'm working on building this 2-scale reconstruction of Mist Island. So, which is quite a project, and it's bigger than I originally thought it was going to be, which is how most of these projects end up. So, but that's a big thing. And then, of course, I don't know if anyone saw my blog post this afternoon about using True Dungeon tokens as a mechanic in my 4E game. And if you're familiar with True Dungeon at all, that's a sort of a live action. It's not really a LARP, but it sort of kind of has elements of that. But you actually have to do physical things to accomplish the goals within the dungeon. And but one of the conspicuous features of that is these tokens that are really they have a nice heft to them. They're about the size of a gold piece, if you will. And they are they represent different items that your character can have. Well, they were giving these out for free over at Gen Con, and I never even actually got to play the game. But they were still giving away packs of 10, and I looked at those, and I thought, well, there's got to be a way to some use these, well, not just let them collect dust. And I thought, why not have them represent things the characters can do, and they would be like automatic things that maybe if they score a critical hit, they can get one of these tokens, use them every so often to be able to accomplish some goal. And I'm going to try that out on the in the next game to see how that mechanic works, because it gives the player something to hold on to. It's sort of like an action point, but it's not used in the same way as an action point. And it, they're not game killers. And I tried to give on most of the items, if you read the post, I've tried to give on most of the items either a, for lack of a better word, a role-playing type of thing you can do with it, or an actual, you know, like game mechanic. So, like, for example, the torch token, you can set fire automatically to one thing. Or
I like it.
You can have your next attack do ongoing 5 points of fire damage.
Nice.
Okay, so it's one or the other, you know. And then once it's used, it's turned back in, and then it can be reused later on, you know. And so, but anyway, read the post. I thought it was kind of an interesting thing to do with those, and it's a mechanic. It's the nice thing about 4E is that it's a flexible enough game that you can do these kinds of things, and not break your game. Or anything like that. So.
I think that WotC could learn from you, because I think all the people that say...
Whoa. Say that a little bit louder and a little bit slower.
I said WotC can learn from Randall. From there Randall. WotC can learn from Randall Walker.
Wow. WotC and now can, I know what Carol has to put up with.
No kidding. Here's why. Because all of those people that say, oh, no cards, these cards suck, you're turning D&D into a card game, WotC can just print the basics of what is on the cards. I'm not talking about the despair deck. I'm talking more about, like, the fate cards and stuff.
Sure.
Because that's basically what you're describing, but you've got it in token form. And if they put those – if they made tokens with those, there are a lot of people – that would find that a lot more conducive to their idea of the game, because they'd treat it like a boon. It's not a card. It's not turning into a card game. It doesn't get lost in their shuffle of power cards. You know, it's right. It's a separate thing that could be just a token, and there it is.
Yeah, so, I think you're right, yeah.
So WotC can learn from you.
You heard it here first, guys. There you go.
Oh, I've also been playing Heroes of Neverwinter.
How is that? I haven't picked up the box set yet. So.
Oh, this is a Facebook game.
I can't stand Facebook. Yeah. I call it Faceplant, so... I just sorry.
Don't be a hater, man.
Here's the, honestly, I have an account. Because I had several people that were like, get an account so I can keep in touch with you. So I have an account, so I'm not like, and I don't, like, I never made fun of my office mates when they were addicted to Farmville. I never did anything like that. I just don't like it.
Whatever.
It's not something I can spend a lot of time on.
Crazy. I'm playing right now, so you can do whatever you want. You can blah, 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 blah.
Yeah. That's why you're never paying attention to
Randall. Is it better than the first D&D game they rolled out?
Yes. This is actually like a game.
Really?
Sorry. I shouldn't be so mean.
The first game kind of sucked. It was sort of boring and repetitive.
Well, and you didn't actually like fight battles.
No, not really.
It's got a square. You go to the adventure board. You find where an adventure you want to go into, and then you actually fight with, like, characters.
Oh, okay.
And then you use your friend's characters to fill out your party.
So it's like that other game.
Thanks, that narrows it down.
Oh, there was another... what is it called? And I haven't played this in forever. Because one of the things that I had to do is recruit other people to play and to fill out your party, and you could, those guys could get items eventually, and you would go into more and more difficult encounters, and you'd earn experience, and oh, I'd swear this sounds exactly like another, and it wouldn't surprise me if it's built on someone else's engine, that wouldn't bother me, but I just, that sounds so familiar, what was it called? Something, I'm sure it was Quest something.
It was a computer game?
No, it was a Facebook game.
Oh. What you're talking about.
Yeah. Man, I can't remember. Well, it escapes me. I hate it when that happens. Go back to Farmville.
It was Farmville. Randall was playing Farmville with Anna. Yeah.
Dude, I played Farmville for about a solid year.
Yeah.
I don't anymore.
I'm in the bandit hideout now.
Dun, dun, dun.
The bandits have converted a storage room in an out-of-way cul-de-sac into a hideout. This game likes to overuse the word cul-de-sac.
Oh, it does, huh?
Yeah. One of the bandits
calls
out... Atari did it. Oh, Nasher's okay, so own will return order and bring the fall of the pretender no matter what the cost. Yeah, whatever, you're gonna die soon. Nasher's on my list now.
That's funny.
But
I have to check it out. I haven't. It does sound really familiar, though. It's like, wait, I've played this game, I think.
Another cool thing is if people use your character to fill out their party, you can go on and spectate. You can watch them and then give them buffs, which I actually like to do. One thing I did like about the original.
Oh my god, this is the same engine. I know this game.
I'm sure.
Atari, you bastards. That's funny, though. I won't tell. Shh, don't tell anybody.
Atari didn't steal its own engine. They just used their engine to develop a D&D game.
No, yeah they just they skinned it.
Yeah, they reskinned their video game engine.
Whatever the original game was,
their faceplant game engine.
Can't remember the name of something Quest.
Yeah, I saw on Twitter that a lot of people were using. Was it Greg Bilsland's Rogue or?
Yeah, it's the only Rogue I could find so far out of my friend. Yeah. Like I need a
Bill's,
Rogue.
Bills Gregland.
Bills yes. Greg.
Bills Gregland. Yeah.
He's an awesome guy.
It's like Night
Macman. Greg Bilsland guy.
I think Bills Greglin and Night Macklin are like a duo, a nighttime duo team.
Nice.
Yeah. So. I don't know what that means.
I wasn't gonna ask.
Yeah, it's probably a good idea.
Ask Jared von Hindemann. But anyway.
Oh man! No, just stop. Yeah.
Hey, you brought it up.
If you say his name three times, he might appear.
Yeah, there you go.
Oh, sweet. I killed the bandits.
Awesome.
On the body of one of the fallen bandits, you find a small lockbox.
You know what? I have a great idea.
You're live podcasting.
Tracy is live podcasting her Neverwinter, whatever, faceplant game. I'll stop it right here, and then I'll start recording, and you can just read everything on the screen, and then we'll release that as a special DMR episode.
Has several sheaves of parchment contain the signature and seal of Marta Vell, patron and benefactor of Neverwinter.
Dun dun dun.
Dun dun dun.
I just want to. I'll just insert dramatic sound effects. That's all. I just sit here and do that. That'll be fun.
Okay, I know I'm boring you.
Do you have plastic?
Plastic?
Do what?
Cellophane, you know, it's the way to make crackling fire noise on the radio.
I'll just say crackling fire noise.
See, that's a crackling fire.
This is lame. I only got 15 gold out of the treasure chest.
That's weak.
So weak.
That's really weak.
Yeah.
Oh, well. Oh, I had poor performance, too. Yay.
Oh, it rates you? That's great. How judgmental. It's like, thanks.
Yeah, so I think it rates you based on, like, your group composition, and I was a level 4, and most of my friends' characters were, like, level 10 or 8, so, yeah, I probably didn't perform very well.
That was the one thing that I hated about Wii games. There's the stepping game. It's an exercise, right? And, like, as you would step and you hit more and more steps in a row, the crowd would start cheering and cheering. But if you misstep, they would, like, start booing. And it's like, oh, my God.
Did they laugh if you fell down?
They didn't laugh, but they would just, like, continually boo. Or like, even worse, the disappointed sigh. They would go,
How do you miss? I mean, you're stepping. You're just walking. What?
No, but you have to time. The steps are timed and you go left, right. You know what I'm saying?
Oh, is it like a music thing or like almost a dance thingy?
Almost, kind of, but not quite as fast.
Yeah, I would suck at that.
It's primarily an exercise, but the idea is that you step in different ways. And the more steps you get in a row, the higher points you score. Well, if you misstep too many times, the crowd starts getting really disappointed. And they go, oh. And it's like 600 people saying that at once, right?
Not
just one guy. And so it's just kind of judgmental. It's like, we game judges you, you know? You suck. It's like, oh, man, this is not helping my self-esteem. I'm supposed to be losing weight. This is not helping. So.
Speaking of that, we bought an elliptical.
Yeah, I think you tweeted about that. Yeah. Nice. Is it working out?
It's awesome.
Are you ripped? Are you ripped like 4?
No, because we've only had it for like 3 days, dude. it doesn't happen that fast.
Damn it.
Unless I was like glued to it and could not get off of the thing and was on there for 3 days, then maybe I would like, yeah, but no. Not yet, but hopefully, because, you know. So, Tracy, I hear you saw Conan.
I did.
And? Spoilers.
Spoilers allowed? Okay.
No. Spoilers allowed. Because I want to see it.
Okay.
I mean, I understand the whole general idea of how Conan goes down, but, you know.
Yeah, I don't know. I can never really get in the first movie, although Fred loves it.
When you say the first, what do you mean the first?
Conan the Destroyer with Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I don't know. I like the first third or so of the new movie, and then it kind of lost me. But that's all I'll say. That's not really a spoiler, I don't think.
He wasn't getting naked often enough, was he, Tracy?
Well, naked? No. It is Jason.
It's the guy that was in Stargate Atlantis, right?
Yeah, and pretty he's Carl Drogo in the Game of Thrones. It's like a Song of Ice and Fire.
Oh, I haven't. Yeah. I can't watch Game of Thrones yet, so.
I think really he gets more naked in there than in this movie. But. I guess
that's why I'll watch it for sure.
Exactly.
Yes. That's okay. I watched Torchwood for Jack Harkness, so I'm not afraid to say that in public.
Oh, really?
Oh, I have Jack? A total... Jack,
No, Randall, the reason you want to go to the movie is because when you get there...
Kiss me, Jack.
No, it's... When you get to the theater, it's going to be full of loose women and liquor.
Well, I have a wife for that.
Yeah.
So I don't need to have a whole theater.
No, they're all going to be at
that's
my house.
Fred's, that's
Fred's. That's right, yeah.
Yeah,
sorry.
Background, yes. So that's... Yes, that's Tracy's house. That's not my house.
Hey, wait, did you see Jack in Doctor Who too?
Oh yeah.
The one episode where they're doing the reality shows?
Yes.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. I love you, Jack. So yes, I want a coat just like his too. I would love to have his coat. Yes, I want your coat, Jack. I'm gonna get letters now. Now I'll get letters like, what the hell?
So if you're going to Conan for at least half nudity, it's in there still.
Which half?
The top half.
Oh.
That's still there. That's still Conan. They definitely have loose women and alcohol in the movie. They took a break from my house to go there.
The entire cast of Conan is at Tracy's house.
Oh, man. That would be nice.
Well, there you go. Lots of violence, so I understand. Lots of blood and heads coming apart and things like that.
Yeah, they have a lot of violence, and I still feel they jack up the sound effects on that stuff, and that's what I don't like. Like, I can deal with violence just fine. It's the overemphasized skull-crushing sounds that get to me.
Oh, lovely. There's the crunch, crunch action.
Yeah.
Oh, nice. Okay.
Which I always feel bad complaining about, because I'm like, yeah, you're just a girl. But no, I just don't like the sound.
It's not pleasant, no. I always kind of go, eh. Didn't really hear that. Look.
But yeah.
That's why I didn't like Alien so much.
Oh, yeah?
The sounds totally creep you out in Alien. I mean, the old egg thing splits open and you hear the all. When it's enough to see mucus, you don't want to hear mucus.
Right.
When you hear mucus, you are too close to the mucus.
Like, I don't mind gunfire, but when it's wet sounding gunfire, I just don't like that as much.
You guys are definitely not biologists.
Whoa. I studied at first to be a biologist, Sam. I'm all about the biology, but I study evolutionary biology.
Dude, you can't watch an egg sack, okay? Come on.
No, I didn't say I couldn't watch an egg sack. I said,
you didn't want to hear mucus.
No. Here is the operative word.
You don't want to hear mucus.
I don't want to hear mucus.
I can see it. I don't mind seeing it, but if I have to hear it too, I am too close to the mucus. And I wish to have a glass in front of me.
We're talking about sacks now. This episode is going off the rails.
It's been off the rails since you started, like, reading your Neverwinter game.
Oh, you think that's when it went off?
Yeah.
Okay. No.
We started off the rails.
Yeah, were we on the rails to begin with?
Yeah, we were off-roading the whole time.
This is what happens when you give players control over the narrative.
Yes!
Oh my god.
Yes, and that is how we will end the podcast. Done. Exactly. That's why it's called the DM roundtable, not the players roundtable.
All right, well then say goodbye and I'll quit recording.
Goodbye.
Bye. We love you.